Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Els close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
We did it.
I always amazed me that we get our timing right.
We can say our names.
How many? 23 years? Something like that.
We are not only proud of being able to say our names, but proud that we've been able to learn to say our names in a really, really unreasonably long period of time.
23 years.
It took us 23 years to do it, and we're very proud of it.
Personal Wealth Coach has been on the air just about every week for 23 years, which is just blows my mind.
Yeah. I remember when you started it. I remember a year later you saying, I need some help. We're going to 2 hours. And so me joining you. So I've been on the air for 22 years. And I think a lot of the listeners heard me go from a inexperienced youth to somebody that sort of semi-sometimes knows what I'm talking about.
I disagree. A lot of listeners, no.
Maybe not a lot. There may be just a few out there that remember. Maybe any of it. Maybe it's just us in the room that remembers the beginning.
I remember it.
Lynn Woolley remembers it.
Yeah, he occasionally harasses us about it. Hey, speaking of the economy and so on, and by the way, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join us. And today is the 26th of October where you are. Hey. Oh, somebody's joining us.
There we go.
Somebody's
it must be the 26th of October where they are.
Yeah, okay. Well, caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
No, as a matter of fact, I'm in Bangkok, Thailand, and it's the 27th, but I'm just calling, you know, just to call.
Good, good. Well, can you tell us how tomorrow's going to be?
Yeah, well, the reason for my call, you know, if you can get on with your business, you say you've been on there for quite a few years. Have you seen quite a bit of equipment change since you've been talking on the radio? And
yes.
When you first started, where was this radio station located at? You have a good day, son.
It was
downtown, and it was there were two radio stations in the building.
And we had it one room with two control rooms attached to it, so two windows looking out to different production rooms.
And it was KTEM and KPLE, which was the FM station.
So,
and they were all together.
You put those two together, the minus the K, you get TEMPLE. That's Temple.
I think Lynn Woolley owned both stations at that point. But
yeah,
that was...
It may have been right before that.
He did.
We had a literal, the machine would type at us and news would come in on that machine.
We had 8-track players to play
the commercials. And that stayed for, I think we only got rid of the 8-tracks about 10 years ago.
Well, yeah, but it really wasn't being used. It was just sitting there gathering dust. But now the dust gathers elsewhere.
Yes. Now it gathers on other things. So we have entered the 20th century, barely.
Yes. So we have another caller?
Yes. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello? Hello?
Okay.
Apparently they didn't want to talk.
Yeah, it's been fascinating watching radio.
Watching radio?
Yeah, because we get to see it. Everybody else has to hear it. We get to watch it. And watching the slow decline of equipment. This desk in here, we've got a relatively new soundboard up on it. It's the same sort of thing you'd see in a recording studio or something like that. But just over to the side, we have on our desk here, we can lift up a piece of the desk and see the turntable underneath it.
When we first started in here.
And it was actually in use when we
first
started.
A couple of years ago, we had the same equipment, it wasn't the same physical identical one, but it was the same model of equipment that I started with in 1965, I think it was, in radio. It's 1965, and it looked the same, it worked the same, and I was able to use it because I'd worked my way through part of high school and college, as a radio DJ and, radio announcer and so on, whatever you want to call it, and it was the same equipment. And I thought it was really cool. And now we got fancy equipment, and Jake operates it because I haven't got a clue how it works.
Yeah. And I've been around enough live music production and so on. I know how to push these buttons. I may not push the right ones, but I know how to push them.
Let me throw another little thing that's happened in a completely different subject. The fiscal year of the United States of America ends on, well, the new year begins on October
1st. The government of the United States of America.
Yes. And we broke some records. But
what day does it end?
It ends at the end of September.
Right. September 30th.
And when it ended, we broke another record. But I'll wait until the caller.
After the call?
After the caller.
Okay. Caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I have a theoretical question, and I don't have to worry about this because I've got a financial planner that takes care of me. But on your Templeton comment last hour, if you were to invest a third in S&P 500, a third in NASDAQ, and a third in Dow Jones Industrial Index funds, what would be the positives or negatives beyond that? Thanks. I'll hang up on my phone.
Okay.
Well, I can tell you
there's some positives and some negatives.
You'd probably get a pretty good, very long-term return, but had you done so in the year 2000, you would have spent about 15 years waiting for recovery.
Yeah. You get some. Here's the positives. There's a lot of diversification there. There's not a lot of expense because it's not really managed. It's basically they're just trying to track those indexes. So the expense side drops a lot. You have a very, very low expense portfolio that's very well diversified, but
well, it's diversified.
I would say it's
stocks, but it's all stocks.
Yeah, it's all stocks, 100% stocks. So it's not diversified across other markets. It's just the stock markets. Okay, so you don't have real estate, you don't have bonds. There's a lot of stuff that you're missing in this. So it's a diversified but fairly aggressive portfolio. It's not designed to be the best performance either. So basically you're taking the approach of I'm going to spread out across all these things, good and bad. There's nobody involved saying, I think this is a good company and I think that's a bad company. And over the last decade, that question, is this a good or a bad company, hasn't had as much a result as in the past. Because over the last decade, basically everything has gone up. And that means you don't have to be good at picking good from bad. You just pick stuff and everything goes up. So there's the danger there. We've gone a decade where you really haven't needed a lot of help to get good returns.
And the other thing that happens during a bull market, by the way, what you just suggested, what you just suggested.
Did your tang get tangled?
Yes. Becomes more and more popular during bull markets, because during bull markets, equities do very, very well.
I've got another quote. I'm going to throw it out there.
What's that?
Bull markets make geniuses of us all. That quote I attribute directly to Jeff McClure.
Well, there's more to it. A bull market makes geniuses of all of us, but a bear shows us for the fools we really are.
Right.
And the point is that...
Exactly so.
And there are people who invest that way. And they haven't been investing a real long time. But the thing one needs to do to effectively assess how an investment is likely to perform, and it's not a certainty. The past performance is no guarantee of future returns, obviously.
Close cover before striking.
But measure, this is the best way to do it. And this is one of the reasons that United States aviation, commercial aviation, is probably it's safer than walking statistically.
Walking statistically doesn't sound like very much fun.
It isn't fun, but your risk walking a mile on a sidewalk next to a highway or next to a street is actually higher than flying in a standard flight
commercial,
in the United States in a commercial airline. The thing is, you need to look, if this is a really good measure, worst case, any investment portfolio you have, in other words, take that philosophy, that investment philosophy, and by the way, the NASDAQ, when you say NASDAQ, I presume you mean QQQ or something similar, because the whole NASDAQ is not available in an investment vehicle. But if you go back to worst case it, what started in 1987, started in 1990, started in
2000.
The year 2000.
Let's find all the tops of the markets, right, and start there and see what happens.
And if you're comfortable start in 1929. Admittedly, the NASDAQ didn't exist in 1929, but the Dow and the S&P 500 did. So you start in 1929. If you start in 1929, by the way, you will discover it's 1954 before you recover, which is not not going to make you very happy. So that is the issue. Even during a bull market, and this is what is hard to do. Even during a bull market.
The Standard & Poor's 500 was introduced in 1957.
Yeah, but there's a predecessor to it that is generally linked to it. Admittedly, the S&P 500 wasn't 500 stocks, but Ibbotson and others have taken it back before that. Anyway,
okay.
So the issue is that if you take a look at the concept that you want to invest in, and you base, first off, we think it's important that you base it on asset classes, and you just basically defined large cap blend asset classes. That's what you just defined by the three different indexes you used. If you go into large cap blend asset class, and you start at any in a number of periods of time, you can see that it could be disastrous. And the point is, with 2020 hindsight, we can look back and see those disasters. But you can't see them coming because
nope.
It's different every time. So the issue is, by diversification, it's important to recognize that there is growth and there is value, and within the equity field, and there's blend, and they're small and large, and they behave differently, and mixing them together according to your need is critical. It is a critical thing to do. Without that, you either take on undue risk or you condemn yourself to return something in the vicinity of below inflation. And it's a little harder than by the way, at the end of a bull market, we see something very similar every time, which is why we think we're coming to the end of this bull market. A high concentration in large cap growth stocks, and the S&P 500 stock index would be in a would be in a correction right now, were it not for the largest 50. If you take the largest 50 growth stocks out of the S&P 500 index, you put it into a recession. You put it into a pretty severe
downturn, a correction. Yeah. So you take
those 50
out, and that's something you can see in the year 2000, something you could see in 1998, something you could see at the top of many of these positions. Are the biggest winners are carrying everything else.
And what
you see in those positions, by the way, and we're starting to see this, is that when people bring in a portfolio for us to examine, guess what stocks we find in those portfolios?
Top 50.
Yep.
And by the way, it even had a name in the 1920s, the Nifty 50.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for example, and we say, well, you know, we say the stock market's not ridiculously overpriced right now. It actually wasn't in 1929 either. There were a couple of stocks that were priced at 73 times earnings. Well, guess what Amazon is today? 73 times earnings.
Yeah, and which is better than it has been in the past.
So
it's not 120 times its earnings.
The point is that at any given moment, as we found out, if those of us who've been around long enough remember 1987, if we found out with no warning at all, and by the way, in 2007, 2008, with no warning at all, we look back and say, oh, any idiot could have seen that coming. Well, obviously, we didn't have any idiots because nobody, you'd go back and look for somebody who predicted a 50% stock market drop in 2007, and you just don't find them. What you find is people say there's a problem coming in the housing area and you ought to be out of real estate. A few people. But they didn't anticipate the fact that it would cause the entire financial system of the world to be at high risk for collapsing. Those are called black swans, and they keep swimming into view on an amazingly frequent basis.
And the reason for the name black swan, I very much like this, because in the medieval times and Renaissance times, people talked about an event that could never happen, and they named it a black swan because every swan that they had ever seen was white. No one in Asia or Europe had seen a black swan. No one in Africa had seen a black swan. So they had a pretty good statement of basically, don't be afraid of the black swan. And there was a they used that term enough until they got to Australia. And swans are black there.
Well, only in northern Australia.
There's a lot of them, though.
Yeah.
So the idea that it's statistically impossible because we've never seen it is one of the things that we remind people regularly. Statistical improbability and statistical impossibility are no different from each other. Statistics are always about measuring things that have already happened. And it's, you can't get any kind of accurate statistics on things that have never happened. You just get zeros. So what's the likelihood of something that's never happened happening? Well, it happens every day.
It does. And
lots of times a day.
We are in, economically and the market indicators, we are in largely uncharted waters, to use a metaphor.
Right. I'm going to give you an example that has nothing to do with the economy. My wife likes to make yogurt on her own. She makes yogurt out of coconut cream. Well, that's interesting. Okay, that's odd. But not crazy odd. Other people make, if you go to the store, you can find coconut yogurt out there. She's buying probiotics to culture the yogurt from coconut cream. And she's reached the edge of known knowledge. There are thousands of probiotics that have never been used to create coconut yogurt before. There's no knowing what will happen with that. Anytime anybody does that, it's statistically impossible because it's never happened before.
Not statistically impossible, it just hasn't happened before. Yeah, let me tell you something else. That's that we're doing a lot of physical experiments, and we've talked about that in the newsletter. And one of them is cutting taxes and raising spendings at the top of an economic boom. We're at virtually zero unemployment in the United States today. We have consumer spending at record levels, and we're mostly a consumer spending-driven economy. We have all these things going on, and we've had them going on for several years now. And at that point, the Congress and the president decided it was a good idea to cut taxes and increase spending. That is a good stimulator in a down market, in a down economy, to kick us out of a recession into growth. But historically, what we've always done at that point is raise taxes and cut spending a little bit and pay down the debt. Well, this time we are doubling down on the debt to see if it helps. And it's a grand experiment. It's really interesting to see how this turns out. And as a result, when the fiscal year of the United States government closed at the end of September, we had a deficit for the year of $984.4 billion. Now, is that an all-time record? No. But it is certainly an all-time record for doing, considering that tax revenues increased for the year. We decided as a people, the people of the United States, because we elected the representatives who did it, when we elected in 2016, when we elected the president and we elected Congress, that we were going to run an experiment. And we're now running the experiment, and it's beginning to have some interesting effects. By the way, for the calendar year, there's virtually complete agreement that the federal deficit will exceed $1 trillion and will continue to exceed $1 trillion a year for at least the next decade, and that's if we have no recession. If we have a recession and tax revenues drop off, then the deficit will really get interesting and grow like mad. And we're seeing, we mentioned a little earlier that, and certainly we talked about it in the newsletter, the Federal Reserve is in a boom time, in a time when everything should be running very smoothly, having to inject increasing amounts of money into the money center banks by buying short-term treasuries from those banks and giving them cash in return, forcing those purchases, it's called a repo market, to put cash in the banks because we were running out of cash to finance the day-to-day activities of the businesses of the United States. And they initially were doing it at $35 billion a day, and then they moved it to they moved it to something, I don't remember, then they moved it to $75 billion a day, and then they, for this weekend alone...
$140 billion.
Yeah, they've said they moved it, they ultimately moved it to $120 million a day, but then they popped another $140 billion into the system, $44 billion or something. What was it?
Well, when you're talking about this much money changing this fast...
$77 billion... just for this weekend. Now, this is in addition to the standard amount that they were pumping into the banks. On Friday, they pumped in an extra $77.3 billion because they anticipated a cash shortage over the weekend. Now, do we understand what is causing this exactly?
No.
But there's a big thing that's going on that I think...
We know a lot of the pieces that are causing this.
I think there's a pretty obvious thing happening here. The Trump administration, for better or worse... decided to do the very high level, the trillion-dollar borrowing, mainly in
this
the very
is the biggest piece, yeah.
In the very short end of the market. In other words, instead of borrowing at 30 years and locking in low interest rates for the next 30 years, they have chosen to borrow in T-bills and T-notes, very short borrowing when they issue these. And as a result, two things are happening. One, they're borrowing more and more money, but two, the big rush in borrowing that started at the beginning of this year.
And by you say rush in borrowing, not Russian borrowing.
The Russians
are not involved.
No.
There was a rush in borrowing.
The dramatic increase in borrowing that's been going on, particularly since the debt ceiling was lifted again, has now been going on long enough that they're having the 90-day T-bills they used to borrow money at the beginning of this period roll over, and they have to refinance them. So it's like an avalanche rolling downhill, and they're basically sucking the cash out of the system to the point where the Federal Reserve is having to step in and buy those T-bills, which is a form of fiscal stimulus, in order to keep the system from locking up. It's basically the short-term overnight borrowing of money in the United States is similar to a lubricant that keeps the gears from locking up with each other. It's like the oil in the system. And this has never happened before at the top of an economic boom. Sure, it happened in 2008 and 9 because everybody just locked up and were afraid to lend anybody money. And that is normal, and that's part of the Federal Reserve's job, is to step in at that point, lubricate the system, and keep everything going. But we've never had it happen before at the top of an economic cycle where the demand is up. And we're in uncharted waters here, folks. There's a grand experiment going on, and we are borrowing $1 trillion a year. The United States of America is running an overdraft of $1 trillion a year, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight. That, I know it's no longer popular to say that running very, very high deficits is not a good idea. It's now very popular to say we can borrow all the money we want and we'll never have to pay it back or something like that.
We still have to fall back on tried and true principles, though. Borrowing more than you make repeatedly, year after year, and increasing it, I've never seen that be a long-term good outcome. And we can say... the United States has been borrowing for a long time, and we're not in a bad position. And we're not. That's absolutely true. The reason why we're not in a bad position is we've actively been fighting to balance the budget. And I know it doesn't seem like it, but we've had moments where we flirt with it, and we keep trying to go back to that. Debt's important. It's important for the health of our society, but too much debt will destroy our economy.
To give you some idea how radical this change is in the recent past, the deficit in a year of record tax revenue is up 26% since last year. We have the amount of money that we need to borrow to keep the government running, as opposed to tax and other revenue, is risen 26% in 1 year. And frankly, that makes me nervous. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Hey, is it not true that the Fed is kind of ripping off the United States of America?
No.
And they really don't have anybody to be accountable to?
That's not true. Yeah, that's not true.
Well, how do you explain that it's not true?
Okay.
There's something called the Federal Reserve Act. That can be abolished by Congress, number one. It just takes a majority to do it. Number two...
Well, how does that make it not true just because Congress can abolish? That doesn't mean it's not happening.
Well, what you just said is they don't answer to anyone.
They answer to Congress.
They answer to Congress. Number two, the voting board, the open market committee, is made up of heads of banks, which is a counterbalance on the banking side, and people that are appointed by the president. Now, they have to have the consent of the Senate. So the Senate advises and consents. So they have a limited term. The bank presidents have rotating seats on this voting board, unless they're for the New York Fed, and there's a couple of others that have permanent seats. The appointed members also rotate out, and they have periods, their terms are overlapped. You can replace them any given year. You're going to be replacing members of that board. So the president has the direct ability to influence that board by who he puts in that position. He's having trouble. He's nominated four people now, and all four have been denied by the Senate, by the Republicans in the Senate, because they don't believe that they have the separation from politics needed to be a good member of the board. You really have to be apolitical. It's very much like a judge. And I still believe very firmly that the vast majority of our judges don't make their decisions based on which president appointed them. They do it based on what they believe is correct in the law.
Okay, but here's my point. If the president can't get his man in there...
But he did.
He has. He's appointed several.
They've been denied by the Senate.
The last four that he has nominated. He hasn't fully nominated two of them. The Senate just said, hey, nominate some other people because those guys aren't qualified.
But the chairman of the Federal Reserve was installed by President Trump.
Yeah. Chairman Powell was nominated and approved.
Confirmed by the Senate.
As was his assistant and several other members that are acting members now. The Federal Reserve... The seated members right now have actively been appointed by the current government. They answer to the government. So they have a whole series of powers that they don't have to ask anyone to use. And that may be what you're talking about. They don't have to go to Congress and say, can I do this? Because there's a law that says they're allowed to do it.
Well, there's a law. The Federal Reserve Act says that here's your mandate. Here's what you'll do.
Okay, well,
and they continue to do it. If they were not to do it, then they'd be in violation of the law and Congress could act against them.
Okay, let me cut to the chase. What I see and what I have read is they flood the market with currency, and then they pull that currency, access to that currency away, and that's what creates the fall.
No.
And that's what I see happening.
All right, let's explain that. Let us explain that to you. Okay. The Federal Reserve was set up to be the lender of last resort. That is the whole concept. There have been lots and lots and lots of financial disasters in the past where banks have failed, not because the bank management has been bad or because they've made bad investments or anything else, except that they had loaned out enough of the money in a normal day that would be totally healthy. But then enough of the customers showed up on one day and panicked and pulled their money out, and it destroyed the bank. Well, that bank could have gotten a short-term loan from the lender of last resort if the Federal Reserve existed to do it. What they do is they step in and they say, you got to pay me back. This is not a gift. You must pay me back, and you're going to pay me interest on it, and that's the interest amount. But I'm going to make you this loan so that you remain solvent. You haven't done anything wrong. So that's what when someone says, we say, that they're pumping money into the system, what they're doing in the repo market or at the interbank lending windows is banks are coming to them and saying, we would like to borrow some money to make sure we have enough reserves on hand between now and next payday when everybody makes their deposits.
The let me give you an example of what the Federal Reserve does and doesn't do. There is virtual complete agreement again among historians and among economists that the events that occurred in 2008 and 2009 would have resulted in another Great Depression had the Federal Reserve not stepped in and did what it did.
Yeah, and they did a whole series of actions there. I think, the most important piece to his comment.
Go ahead.
The people on the board at the Federal Reserve are not paid a huge amount of money, and they're restricted in what they can own. This isn't true in many cases with Congress. It's very true with the Federal Reserve.
And this is it's really important to recognize that it's like saying that if you have smoked cigarettes and otherwise done unhealthy things for your lungs and you get lung cancer and the surgeon operates on you and the oncologist gives you the radiation and the chemotherapy and you die anyway, it's the fault of the doctors. The Federal Reserve is in the position of trying to fix things when they go wrong. Otherwise, they have a hands-off approach to things. Their job is first to keep the dollar sound, which they've done an exceptional job of doing if you look at the dollar versus every other currency in the world. The second one is to generate full employment. Well, the last time I looked, we've got full employment.
Right.
We got a third mandate, but I don't remember what it was. But anyway, their mandates are to do those three things. They're not to prevent recessions. Oh,
it's to calm the markets is the third one, and that's a near impossible
task. And they have done – what they're doing right now is calm the market. They basically said – the money center banks came to them and said, we don't have enough short-term cash. And the Federal Reserve said – the Federal Reserve is not going to give them money. Said, well, have you got some treasury bills? They said, yeah, we got a lot of treasury bills because we're obligated to buy them because the government is borrowing a lot of money and we're obligated to buy the treasury bills. And they said, okay, we'll take the treasury bills as collateral and loan you a bunch of money.
Right.
And they did, and they kept the system running.
Those bills are still owned by those banks.
And it was,
but they used that as collateral for a loan.
There's no question also that we used to have double-digit inflation in the 1980s. And the Federal Reserve is given virtually single-handedly is given credit for reducing inflation down to near zero and keeping it there.
Now, having said all of that, if we don't maintain the checks and balances on the system that are there, the Federal Reserve could turn into a monster. That's what, you know, Thomas Jefferson was afraid of, that we would have a central bank that was more powerful than the government. It's part of the reason why he didn't want to have a standing military as well, because they was afraid that we would have a military that was more powerful than the government. We have checks and balances in both of those places based on that deep early fear that either the country was going to get taken over by bankers or by the military, because it happens in other countries quite regularly. I mean, the country of Egypt right now was taken over by the military. Who took over the finance section? It's not uncommon for finance and coups to go hand in hand. So having a balance in there to make sure apolitical decisions are being made. The Federal Reserve has no business making a decision that benefits someone politically but hurts the economy.
The Civil War can be traced back, you know, there's a simplistic thing about slavery and there's a lot to do with it, but if you actually trace the Civil War's origins back, you find that the Depression of 1837 was what triggered a series of events that ultimately became the United States Civil War. The Depression of 1837, which was a real bad one, effectively bankrupted the South the president took some actions, but the first thing that Andrew Jackson did to cause the crisis was to abolish the Second Bank of the United States, which was equivalent to today's Federal Reserve. And when he abolished it, he abolished it very simply by taking all the federal funds away from it.
And deposited it in banks that were known then at the time as the pet banks.
The banks that had supported him for president. And when he did that, he created a dynamic, a series of events that ultimately wound up with the United States dividing itself in half and going to war and killing millions of people. No major country or economy in the world has ever been successful without an independent central bank.
Now, it has to be controlled or the independent central bank takes over, becomes a worse evil than what it's preventing.
I agree. But it, and when I say an independent central bank, obviously the Congress can step in at any point and abolish the Federal Reserve. And they know that. They can change the Federal Reserve Act at any point with a simple majority and say, you can't do this or you must do that. And the Federal Reserve really knows it. And the members of Congress, the leaders in Congress particularly.
Congress regularly threatens to audit them.
But they are audited.
Yeah.
The point is it's independent auditors, not Congress, which make it political.
Right. If Congress audits them, then it's the Democrats in Congress auditing the Federal Reserve. Do we want that? If Congress audits them under the Republicans, then it's the Republicans in Congress and auditing the Federal Reserve and wanting political outcomes. The Federal Reserve is audited 3 times a year by major accounting firms, not by Congress. And we have a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm glad to hear what you said about the Civil War economic reasons why it was started. Is it not true that the South was so successful in the textile markets that the North was relying on the exports of the textile materials that were being exported out of the country, and they were taxing the South, and that's what led to a lot of the problems, and also that during the Civil War, that Russia backed the North, and that England and France backed the South, and Russia made sure that the South did not was not able to overpower the North, and that's why England did not support Russia when Russia fell to the communists.
Wow.
Oh, well, there's a lot to cover there.
Well, let me
start with the textiles.
Yeah, that's the gist of it, gentlemen.
Yeah,
would like to talk about it, but I know you guys are trying to be too adhere to the truth, and just the fact that you mentioned that there was an economic factor to the Civil War is breath of fresh air.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you. All right, so let me kind of throw in the textile side of things, and part of the reason why slavery became such a big issue, because there's some points that are easy to point out. Robert E. Lee had left in his will to emancipate all of his slaves. There were quite a few Southerners that were not pro-slavery. But at that point, slaves were the only method of transportable wealth, because the South had gone through some pretty horrible economic things. Excuse me. So on the textile front, you're right. Only it wasn't that the South was strong in textiles. The South was strong in cotton. Textile was manufactured in the North, where they have all the waterfalls.
There's a reason that it had to go to the North.
Right.
And it's called the Tariff of 1833.
Right.
Which was an accident, by the way.
And what had happened is that the essence, and I'm not going to get into a lot of the detail here. I'm going to gloss over this, but I'm going to hit the high points. The South was no longer able to export raw cotton outside of the United States.
Not economically.
Not economically, because it was too expensive.
Because it was a tariff that the president had imposed.
The president imposed a tariff, and it was responded with more tariffs from other places. So Europe had tariffs as a response to a tariff from the United States, saying we're not going to buy raw cotton without charging a huge amount of money on top of it. So the South turned to the North, who already had textile mills. They're all set up on these big waterfalls, and at the time that was the source of energy to create anything industrial. And textiles was – you had these big looms that were water wheel powered. And so you could make the cotton immediately into cloth. The North would pay the South in paper currency, paper dollars.
Very specifically something called a Dixie.
Yes, the Bank of Louisiana out of New Orleans – printed bilingual money, French and English. And this talks about something we talked about last week about the different currencies active in the country at the same time. why we now say this note is legal tender for all debts,
public and private,
is because at times in the past we've had dollars that wouldn't accept these, and the South used the $10 bill for most of its big transactions. And in French, 10 is dix, D-I-X. In the South, that was just pronounced the Dixie. So there's the Mason-Dixon line and the Dixie share the title of the reason why the South was the land of Dixie. So the South is being paid for its raw cotton in Dixies. The North turns the raw cotton into textiles and ships it off to Europe, who pays in gold. After 1837 or 1836,
when it was
the specie circular, Andrew Jackson said, we're not going to accept any debt payments
to the government
that aren't backed by gold or silver. Well, the South was very, very specie poor, specie being gold and silver, because they'd been taking all their money in dollars from the North in paper currency.
Paper dollars.
While the North is doing its transactions with Europe in gold and silver. So that was a huge problem. And part of the reason why Britain and France supported the South is because they saw the South as if they could cause the South to be strong enough to maintain a fight with the North, then they wouldn't have to worry about the United States as a whole.
I don't think Russia supported the North significantly because Russia was basically a third world backwater on the other side of the planet with no...
They supported in very small amount, but verbally.
But they didn't have the ability to... They didn't have a lot of exports. They didn't have a lot of import. They were really a backwater country in the mid-1800s. That was trying to become part of Europe and trying to modernize. They're principally an agricultural, and they didn't have much in the way of seaports. They didn't have much of anything, as a matter of fact.
They were involved in the Revolutionary War quite a bit. But the American Civil War, this is something that there are enough rumors about the Russian involvement to say, dig in and research it, because if you look in reputable places, they say the myth is out there, the rumor is out there, but we can't find the evidence. And that's the thing, is that nobody's saying it didn't happen, but there's no clear proof. And we have another caller on 773-1400. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question for you. If y'all and some of these Chinese companies are banned from doing business through the Defense Department, how come they are bundled on Wall Street if we have a trade ban against them for our technologies?
Okay, that's a good question.
Well, they haven't been banned from being traded on Wall Street, particularly as what's called ADRs, American Depository Receipts, because Wall Street certainly wants to maintain its role as the principal stock market trading center in the world. The fact that Huawei, for example, the Defense Department is not allowed to buy electronics from Huawei because the story is, true or not, that their electronics are being used to spy on us. Despite the fact, by the way, that the majority of cameras and Defense Department installations around the world are Huawei cameras right now.
And this is important. Huawei is not a publicly traded company, so it's not available on the stock exchange. It is traded in China, and there are ways of investing in that. This is how the investment in Huawei happens on Wall Street. Oracle, Intel, Verizon, Apple, there's a lot of companies that sell parts to Huawei, and that may be what you're talking about. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, but see, too, they're also tied up in part of the retirement.
I don't think so. They're not publicly traded.
But see, publicly traded or not, when you get like mutual bonds and these others, that's all tied in together, right?
No. When you have a mutual fund, a mutual fund is something called the Investment Company Act of 1940 packaged product. It means that they're not allowed to buy privately traded companies. That's when somebody says, I'm in private wealth management, They may be buying from employees of Huawei. Employees of Huawei are who own Huawei. It's very communist. It's interesting. It came out of a communist country. So the employees of Huawei own Huawei. That there is a myth out there that the Wall Street is trading Huawei and so on. The trade that's happening there is just as bad as the myth, but it's real. And that is a lot of companies selling stuff to Huawei. Once the president said you can't sell to Huawei, that's what just about put them out of business, because they couldn't do this brand new technology of 5G. They were the leaders in the world in it, but they couldn't do it without parts to the machines that they made that were made in the United States. So it nearly put them out of business before the president then said, okay, we're going to allow a limited sale to Huawei. And that's worth digging into, because how it happened and how much was allowed to sell, had the president is the one that says if Americans are allowed to sell to them at all. And it was being used in the negotiation for the trade talks back and forth with China. So what really is going on there? The president has the ability to shut down Huawei. He's feeding them little tidbits to make them say yes to things. And that's what's going on. And I'm not thinking that there's a great deal of brilliance going on here. The Chinese just showed a lot of hurt. If Huawei went away, it's kind of their poster of good success. And unfortunately, we've got to play some commercials. So I'm going to play the commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I feel like I've been monologuing now. You did more last hour. We'll play the commercials. We'll be back on the other side. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here in the last 5 minutes of the second hour here is 773-1400, 254-773-1400. I just looked that up to refresh my memory. The Russians during the Civil War were pointedly neutral. Now, the State Department actually published some pamphlets claiming the Russians supported the Union. But the Russians didn't know about it. The Russians did, in fact, sail some ships. And this is where the basis of the rumor came from. The myth, sail some ships from France and Great Britain in, and they docked and set up in U.S. harbors, but they only did that because they were afraid if Russia went to war with France and Great Britain, they'd get trapped. And the Russians, as I said, didn't have year-round ports, and they were iced in, so they couldn't sail home. So they sailed here and spent several months in the United States before they sailed back to Russia.
Now, their ships didn't. And this is known. Their ships didn't interact in any way in the armed conflict.
Right. Russia was strictly neutral during the Civil War. By the way, in the Revolutionary War, as Jake mentioned, Russia theoretically was neutral, but actively supported the rebels, the United States, against Great Britain, and did a lot of good. We basically had pretty good relationship with Russia up until the communists took over.
Right, and then we had a hot war with them during the Bolshevik Revolution. We had quite a bit of American troops stuck there.
And we
took us about a year to get them out.
One of the reasons we were against the communist revolution in Russia wasn't because we were anti-communist per se. It was the fact we'd had a long, very friendly relationship with the Imperial Russian government. And we had treaties with them, and that's one of those little pieces of history that's often overlooked.
It's sort of like Cuba. The real reason why we're upset with Cuba is that they took a lot of money from people and didn't give it back.
Yeah.
That we don't like that, and that's the big thing.
And a lot of their families are still in Florida and vote.
Yes, and that reinforces that we don't like the government of Cuba.
We don't like the government of Cuba. That's a fact.
We're about out of time. Just a few minutes left.
Let me give a little summary here for the economy. Basically, every aspect of manufacturing and business, not only in the United States economy, but around the globe, is headed downhill, and pessimism is rising. Business investment is falling off. Long-term investment, capital investment is falling off. Those historically have been indicators of where we're going in the future. Without capital investment, a year or two later, businesses begin to sag. Consumer spending is still propping up the United States economy. However, for September, for the first time in a long time, we saw consumer spending start to decline. Now, what does that mean? Does it mean it's going to decline every month into the future? I don't know. The businesses are saying the biggest cause of their concern is the tariffs, the trade war. If the trade war worsens, odds are we will go into a recession in 2020. If it stays the same, odds are we'll go into a recession in 2020. If it suddenly gets released, it probably bumps it back a year. But that's kind of a summary of what's going on. What do you need to do about it? Have a well-diversified portfolio, good cash reserves, but don't try to time the market.
And don't panic in the middle of this.
Right.
We're about out of time. It is normal to have recessions. Just write it out.
And a boom is probably coming on the other side.
If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
There's real live people during the week. You can also reach that same line at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read about our philosophy, see our beautiful staff and our made-for-radio faces. You can read our newsletter and listen to recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. You can also contact us through the contact form or email us directly at Jeff or Jake at TPWC.